The Man Who Was Sherlock Holmes, the story of the famous detective and his creator, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
Dr. Watson, sir.
Yes, what is it?
There's a person to see you, sir. I told him it was after consulting hours, but he would insist.
Oh, well, show him in.
Very good, sir. Will you come in, then?
Oh, thank you kindly. You're surprised to see me, sir?
Oh, it's you. I asked what the devil you want.
I've a conscience, you see. When I chanced to see you step into this house, I thought to myself, well, I'll just go up and tell that gentleman that if I was a bit sharp in my manner when he nearly bowled me over in his speech this morning, well, there was no harm meant at all.
No, I think nothing of it.
Very obliging of you to pick up my books the way you did, Dr. Watson, sir.
You know my name, then?
Well, sir, I'm a neighbor of yours. There's a bookshop at the corner of Fifth.
Are you?
Perhaps you're a collector yourself?
No, I...
Here, sir, British Bird, Tertullus, the Holy War, the bargain, every one of them.
I really don't
beautiful condition, sir. 5 volumes. Just in that gap on your second shelf there.
Where?
In the bookcase, maybe behind you, sir.
Gap? I don't see any gap. But here, sir, I... Holmes! It's...
Dear me, I do believe he's fainted.
Watson, my dear Watson.
The fictional date of this dramatic scene was April 1894. The effect of it upon the British public in October 1903, when the story, The Empty House, appeared in the monthly Stand magazine, was every bit as startling. From then on, there would be queues at the bookstalls whenever a new Sherlock Holmes story was due. At the news of his death 3 years before, sober, respectable Victorian gentlemen had gone about wearing black crepe mourning bands. Now the equally respectable, though perhaps not quite so sober, Edwardians were transported with joy and all over the return of a character of fiction whose only existence is on the printed page and in the imagination of readers. Now who was this Sherlock Holmes who had achieved such influence? Who is he, rather, for he's still with us? An immortal who walks and talks and smiles his sardonic smile in every part of the globe. Let's go back to 1886. A young doctor of medicine with a flair for writing adventure tales, Arthur Conan Doyle, sits beside the parlor fire of his sparsely furnished house at Southsea, discussing crime and detection with his mother.
The terrified woman rushing up to the cabin. He's going in search of a policeman. John Reed had been 7 years in the force. John Reed went back with them.
Go on, Arthur.
But that's all I've said, ma'am. It's only a note.
Really,
Arthur. I'm quite sure that
is it, Arthur.
That's what it's promising, isn't it? Well, I think there's something in the cabman.
He could move where he liked in his cab, without anyone suspecting him.
That's quite a good idea. But very original.
Exactly, ma'am. I want to do something original. There have been detective stories before. Edgar Allan Poe, Wilkie Collins, Saborio. But I'm not thinking of a police mission so much as...
What, Arthur?
A consulting detective. A man in private practice using his own methods. People take their problems to him. Even the official police, when they are baffled by a case, he solves them for them.
Brilliant. But Arthur, you have to solve the problems before you can make him solve them.
You're always right, ma'am. But you know, I fancy I could. I don't see why criminal investigation shouldn't become an exact science like any other. Yet, in a way, it's like medicine. A patient comes to me with a pain, a growth. He doesn't tell me what's wrong with him. I tell him. I discover his symptoms. I find their origin. I prescribe a cure.
Yes, I see.
Diagnosis, ma'am. Remember Joe Bell?
Professor Bell. Your tutor at Edinburgh University.
Time and again, I found that he'd learn more of a patient by a few quick glances than I had by all my questions. Did I ever tell you about the Highlander?
I don't think so.
One day I was showing in the patients one by one to where Bell sat, surrounded by his dressers and students. And he just looked at this particular man and said to him, "Well, my man, you've served in the army." "Aye, sir." "Not long discharged from a Highland regiment?" "Aye, sir." "A non-commissioned officer?" "Aye, sir." "Stationed in Barbados?" "Aye, sir." "You see, gentlemen," Joe Bell explained to us afterwards, "he was a respectful man, but he didn't remove his hat. They don't in the army. But he'd have learned civilian ways if he'd been discharged long. He was obviously a Scot, and he had an air of authority. As to Barbados, well, his complaint is elephantiasis, which is West Indian, not British."
"How remarkable."
"It became simple enough when he explained it. But can't you imagine it, ma'am? A detective who could do that sort of thing?"
"Yes. Yes, indeed I can."
The coat sleeve, the trouser knee, the boots, the callosities of the forefinger and thumb. Any one of these might give him a clue."
"Yes. But your detective must have a companion. Someone to listen to his deductions."
"The storyteller. Ormond Sacker, the teller of the tale."
"Ormond Sacker? Oh, no, Arthur. Too fanciful by far."
"Oh, well, I..."
"And you must find something more commonplace, more honest, dependable. English."
"I know. Watson. Jimmy, you've met Dr. Watson, have you?"
"No."
"He's a friend of mine, the Lutheran Scientific Society. I'm sure he wouldn't mind if I borrowed his name. And I'll call him John instead of James. Dr. John H. Watson. Ma'am, I can't wait to get to my desk and begin."
By the end of the century, enterprising publishers had recognized that a rapidly growing public waited eagerly to be entertained in print. The Strand magazine, which would survive until after the Second World War as the best popular monthly of its kind, appeared for the first time in 1891. Arthur Conan Doyle, now married, and with two great historical novels, Micah Clark and The White Company, already written, and on the point of abandoning medicine for full-time writing, submitted a series of six stories featuring Holmes and Watson. The Strand printed one a month for 6 months. So it was that the adventures of Sherlock Holmes and John H. Watson, M.D., were among the first stories to be read by countless men, women, and children. Pressed for Fillmore Holmes stories, he refused, procrastinated, hesitated, then submitted. Writing to his mother to tell her that his task was nearly completed, he said,
"I think of slaying Holmes in the last story and winding him up for good and all. He takes my mind from better things."
The ma'am, to whom Conan Doyle always listened, protested vigorously. For 11 happy months, readers of the Strand magazine were permitted to indulge in their favorite brand of escapism without hint of what was to befall them. Then, Dr. Watson exploded a bombshell.
"It is with a heavy heart that I take up my pen to write these last words in which I shall ever record the singular gift by which my friend, Mr. Sherlock Holmes, was distinguished."
How many readers, faced with a shattering opening to a story ominously titled The Final Problem, can have resisted turning at once to its ending? Yet even this frantic act was unnecessary. Sidney Paget, whose illustrations so magically captured the spirit of the stories, had provided a grim, full-page drawing, uncompromisingly captioned, "The Death of Sherlock Holmes." It showed a sheer cliff wall, overlooking a boiling torrent of foam and spray. At the end of a narrow ledge, two figures were locked in deadly combat. A deerstalker cap floated down into the abyss. From its owner's perilous posture, It was only too clear that he must shortly follow it.
An examination by experts leaves little doubt that a personal contest between the two men ended in their reeling over, locked in each other's arms. Any attempt at recovering the bodies was absolutely hopeless. And there, deep down in that dreadful cauldron of swirling water and seething foam, will lie for all time the most dangerous criminal and the foremost champion of the law of their generation. I shall ever regard him as the best and wisest man whom I have ever known.
It remains the most remarkable killing off in literature. A popular author deliberately doing away with his most celebrated character, but prevented by an unconscious literary instinct from doing away with him irrevocably. Suppose, for instance, he had made Holmes and Moriarty shoot one another instead. Their pistols rang out together, Watson would have told us. Hurrying to Holmes's side, he would no doubt have been just in time to catch some last utterance before the light died from those once-piercing eyes. Holmes would have been seen to be dead, and soon, before a coroner, would have been proved to be dead. The same conditions apply had he been stabbed, poisoned, strangled, or done to death by any of 100 means. Instead, he went over a cliff while Watson's back was turned. This time, there was no listening to persuasion. No trying to put editors and publishers off with playful demands for higher fees. More than 7 years passed. Years crammed full of public and private activities, which made Conan Doyle's life the equivalent of the life of two or three other persons. It is March 1901. Weary from his exertions on his country's behalf in the South African War, and pulled down by enteric fever, Conan Doyle was recuperating at Cromer in the company of Fletcher Robinson, a golfing friend from the West Country.
Well, there goes our last chance of a round today, Robinson.
Never mind. We've a cheerful fire to ourselves. Very cozy.
In fact, the ideal atmosphere for some of your West Country reminiscences.
If you like.
Did I tell you about the phantom hound on Dartmoor?
You certainly did not.
Well, it seems that sometime in the 17th century, there was a lord of the manor. His name was Hugo, a wild, ruthless fellow who took a fancy to the daughter of a local farmer. One Michaelmas, he carried her off and locked her in an upstairs room at his manor while he and his cronies got drunk downstairs. He opened a window, clambered down the ivy, and ran off across the moor.
Good for her.
Mm. But when he found that she had gone, Hugo unkenneled his dogs and rode after her. His friends followed. They hadn't gone more than a mile or two when they met a shepherd who told them he'd seen Hugo galloping past on his black mare, followed by such a hound of hell as God forbid should ever be at my heels.
Go on.
They rode on, rather apprehensively, I imagine, until they came to a hollow. There the girl lay, dead from exhaustion and fear. And nearby lay Hugo, with a great black hound standing over him, tearing out his throat.
Good Lord.
They say that one of the men who saw it died of sheer horror that same night, and the rest were left nervous wrecks. Well, that hound is said to have plagued Hugo's family ever since. Without a word of a lie, there are people in those parts to this day who won't cross the moor in the dark.
Robinson?
Hmm?
I'd like to visit Dartmoor as soon as possible. You go with me?
Of course.
You must show me everything. This hound story has the makings of a real creeper, Robinson.
A real creeper.
Such was the origin of The Hound of the Baskervilles, perhaps the greatest crime thriller ever written, and certainly the most celebrated adventure of Sherlock Holmes and John H. Watson. Yet, at the time of its writing, Holmes lay unresurrected beneath the torrents of Reichenbach. The truth is that when Conan Doyle heard Robinson's account of the legend, no thought of Holmes entered his mind. Only as he and Robinson explored Dartmoor did he realize that if ever there was a mystery calling for Sherlock Holmes to unravel, this was it. But to restore Holmes to life would be to offer Conan Doyle's incubus its former seat on his shoulders again. So he explained the anomaly away as an earlier adventure of Holmes, hitherto unchronicled by the bereaved Watson. In 1902, Arthur Conan Doyle was knighted for services to his country, and a misguided shop assistant addressed a parcel of shirts to him as Sir Sherlock Holmes, receiving the fright of his life when he was summoned to explain himself to the irate recipient. Then an American editor offered the fantastic fee of $5,000 a story for as many Holmes adventures as Conan Doyle cared to write. He struggled, then took up a postcard and wrote, "Very well, A.C.D."
There, my dear Watson. Feeling better?
Oh, Holmes, my dear chap. Stupid of me to faint like that, but I was so overjoyed to see you.
I sense the dramatic again. Do forgive me.
Yeah, not at all. But sit down and tell me how you came alive out of that dreadful chasm.
Well, I'd no serious difficulty in getting out of it for the very simple reason that I was never in it.
Never in it?
Oh, I had little doubts when I saw Moriarty standing on that ledge waiting for me that I'd come to the end of my days. He drew no weapon. He rushed at me and threw his long arms round me. We tottered together on the brink. I have some knowledge, however, of baritsu, or Japanese wrestling, which has been useful to me more than once. I slipped through his grip.
Ah.
He gave a horrible scream, kicked madly for a few seconds, and clawed the air with both hands. I saw him fall, but a long way. Then he struck a rock, bounced off, and flashed into the water.
Great heavens! But the cracks. I saw with my own eyes that two steps went down the path and none returned.
Well, it came about this way.
But how did
you... Your picturesque account, which I read with great interest some months later, you assert that the rock wall behind that ledge was sheer.
Yes, yes.
This was not literally true.
Oh.
A few small footholds presented themselves. Now, to have walked back along the ledge would have meant leaving footmarks. And you, or someone else, would certainly have deduced that I had walked safely away. Therefore, I risked the climb.
And left me to think you dead all these years.
It was all important that I should be thought dead, even by you, or you wouldn't have written your convincing account of my unhappy end.
Well, yes, yes, I see.
So it is, my dear Watson, that I find myself in your comfortable armchair once more, glad with all my heart to share a fireside with my old friend.
Holmes was glad, Watson was glad, the public was delighted. And Conan Doyle recognized the quality of the characters he had created and was grateful for the faithfulness of their admirers. Moreover, the diagnostic wizard of his Edinburgh days, Dr. Bell, had written to him, "You are yourself, Sherlock Holmes." Once more, Dr. Bell was right. The real grounds for terming Conan Doyle the man who was Sherlock Holmes concern his astonishing, intuitive genius for detective investigation. His influence, working sometimes through Holmes, sometimes on his own account, upon European and Asiatic criminology, was widespread. The Sûreté named its crime laboratories at Lyon after him. The Egyptian police used his methods in their training, and the Sherlock Holmes stories were made standard reading in several other police forces. His inventiveness in the matter of plaster casts for preserving imprints, in the differentiation of tobacco ashes, and in the examination of dust from suspect's clothing, all helped to pioneer techniques which are now taken for granted. Not surprisingly, members of the public in distress would often write to Conan Doyle, though their letters were frequently addressed to Sherlock Holmes, seeking his aid. And when he could, he helped them. There was, for example, the case of a man who had drawn out his entire bank balance, visited a London music hall, returned to his hotel, changed out of his evening clothes, and vanished. The police were baffled. The man's relatives wrote to Conan Doyle.
The first clear deduction was that the man had meant to disappear. Why else should he draw out all his money? The hotel door had been locked shortly after the theatergoers had returned, let us say at midnight. Therefore, the man had left the hotel before midnight, unnoticed by anyone. The inference is that he had done it while the hall was full of returning theatergoers, which would be from 11 to 11:30. But why should a man, wishing to hide himself, go out at such an hour? If he intended to hide in London, he need never have gone to the hotel in the first place. Clearly, then, he had left to catch a train. Now, a man who arrives by train at a bit might easily be noticed and remembered later. Therefore, I reasoned, his destination was some large town, a terminus, where he could lose himself in the crowd. When I turned up the timetable and saw that the great Scottish expresses bound for Edinburgh and Glasgow started at about midnight, my case was complete.
The missing man's relatives received this solution by return of post. It was found to be absolutely correct. Some 2 years later, Conan Doyle embarked on another campaign.
An elderly woman, Miss Gilchrist, was done to death most brutally in her flat in Glasgow while her maidservant, Helen Lambie, was absent for 10 minutes on an errand. Her head was beaten to pieces by some hard instrument. The neighbors were alarmed by the noise, and one of them actually saw the murderer, a young man, leave the flat and pass him at the door. The motive of the crime did not appear to be robbery, for nothing was missing except a single diamond brooch. On the other hand, a box of papers had been broken into and left in disorder. The date was December the 21st, 1908.
When a description of the missing brooch was circulated, a man came forward to tell the police that a person known to him as Oscar had pawned a brooch resembling it. The police went to Oscar's lodgings. He had left suddenly for America. The American police were informed, and witnesses who claimed to have seen the murderer leave the flat were sent across the Atlantic to make an identification. They did. Oscar Slater, a German Jew who had been living in Glasgow for some years, was brought back and charged with murder.
It was found beyond all doubt that the brooch in question had been in Slater's possession for years and had nothing to do with Miss Gilchrist at all. This should have been the end of the case, but the public had lost its head, and so had the police. Slater was poor and friendless. He had lived with a woman, which shocked Scotch morality. As one writer bluntly said in the press, even if he didn't do it, he deserved to be condemned anyhow. A case was made up in the most absurd manner. A half-crown card of tools was found in his box. The frail hammer was evidently the instrument which had beaten in the woman's skull. The police description was amended so as to be nearer to Slater. He, a sallow, dark-haired Jew, was picked out by witnesses from among a group of fair Scotsmen. A clear alibi was proved, but as his mistress and his servant girl were the witnesses, it was not allowed.
And there was a perfectly innocent explanation for Slater's abrupt departure for America. But he was convicted and condemned. 2 days before the date of his execution, with the scaffold already erected, he was reprieved and sent to prison for life.
It is an atrocious story. And as I read it and realized the wickedness of it all, I was moved to do all I could for the man.
Once more, Conan Doyle tore the prosecution's evidence to shreds, but provided an alternative solution. That a document in the rifled box had been the intruder's objective, implying that he'd been no stranger to Miss Gilchrist's affairs or to the old lady herself. Over the years, evidence in support of this Holmesian theory came from several quarters, until the authorities could brush it aside no longer. Oscar Slater was released from jail. He had been there for 19 years. No mention of pardon or compensation was made. Conan Doyle kept up his pressure, persuading MPs to demand the public inquiry. He succeeded. Oddly enough, it was on this occasion that Conan Doyle met, for the first time, the man for whom he had fought for nearly 20 years. He had the satisfaction of hearing Slater's appeal upheld and compensation granted. The identity of Miss Gilchrist's killer never emerged.
Shortly before his death, Conan Doyle confided it to his son. And to this day, Adrian Conan Doyle's lips remain sealed. In the early days of the Holmes stories, the public saw none of the links between their detective idol and his creator. Holmes's vivid reality was sufficient. This being so, what would have been easier for Conan Doyle than to have made Holmes his personal mouthpiece, his propaganda vehicle in the Crusades, which took up so much of his life? Yet in all Holmes's utterances, and he made some pretty profound ones, there's hardly one of which it can be said, there speaks Conan Doyle. No campaigning for religious freedom, for divorce reform, no defense of the reputation of the British soldier, not one scrap of special pleading for spiritualism, about which he cared so passionately, and which some people believe, incorrectly, to have been the cause of his abandoning popular fiction. If the public's hero, Sherlock Holmes, had spoken up for these things, there would certainly have followed a wave of interest and support, but Conan Doyle's artistic integrity forbade him. Yet, in fostering the immortality of Sherlock Holmes as a detective, man of action, philosopher, humanitarian, champion of justice, and smiter of evil, we are paying tribute to the man who created him and distilled some part of his own immortality into his creation. Let Holmes have the last word for them both.
I think that I may go so far as to say that I have not lived wholly in vain. If my record were closed tonight, I could still survey it with equanimity. In over 1,000 cases, I am not aware that I have ever used my powers upon the wrong side.
That was The Man Who Was Sherlock Holmes by Michael and Molly Hardwick. The narrator was Richard Herndl, and the part of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was played by Marius Goring. The Great Detective was played by Alan Wheatley, and his assistant, Dr. Watson, by James McKechnie. Production for the BBC was by Joe Burrows.